I'm planning on listening to your interview with Lizzie Maryland.
It was really fun, and I was looking forward to it. And Caravelle, it's one of those scenarios that you can appreciate it. Having worked with any number of owners and breeders over the years, the initial reaction to the story that it was going to be the last start for Caravelle under her name as trainer before being turned over to Graham Motion. And the story is obviously that Bobby Flay caught a wave and saw Caravelle as a horse to buy into, both for current racing action and he's really crafted this pretty elite broodmare band and has had several seven-figure sellers, actually, with mares like America. And, the initial reaction from a lot of people was, oh, that's so sad, they're taking it away from a small... And Lizzie explained, it was the offer, she picked the offer because she had, obviously, Bobby leaving her with significant degree of input and control and that she was totally comfortable with it. It's one of those, I don't want to call it even a harsh reality. It's a reality. It's part of the game as a business.
Yeah. And also, Bobby Flay bought 75%. She kept 25%. She trains the horse at Fair Hill in the barn next to Graham Motion, I guess. She's very friendly with Graham and she understands how the game works. The new owner and Graham Motion has, gone this route before. So, I agree with her and you. There was nothing really negative about it. She cashed out on this filly. She put this filly, as I pointed out in my article, she put her on the Wanamaker site last October, and she was the filly was $330,000 RNA. I mean, geez, what a bargain that is, huh? Because Bobby paid significantly more than that for her.
Yeah. it speaks to the need that or the requirement, really, if you're if you're serious about this, of perusing all the catalogs. You mentioned the Wanamakers and these digital these digital sales are they're not getting the same publicity, obviously, as the scheduled catalog sales do, Sid. And as a result, there's horses now on a more regular basis between formal sales that are being offered up. And instead of some people waiting for a formal bloodstock distribution sale, they're offering them up. You had a sale yesterday, right? There was one, just one yesterday.
Yeah, these sales actually are really excellent innovations that have really taken off during the COVID era. The Wanamaker, for example, just debuted last June, I believe. And, that's a monthly sale. And they're actually excellent vehicles for horses of racing age. Claiming rate horses was a primary thing for lower level horses to be moved, but this gives a higher level horse a chance to get moved. And what's beneficial about this is that the horse never leaves the trainer's barn. So, you have a certain number of days to bid on the horse, but the horse is still with the trainer. So there's no shipping involved. There's no taking the horse out of training. So you have, a lot of beneficial things, and you have a lot of time to research that horse. On the same sale, I pointed out in the article, Anne Merriman, Lizzie's sister, sold a gelding, homebred gelding, Fia, for $400,000. And that gelding was purchased by Robert Masiello has since won 4 out of 5 starts, including two black type races. So, you know, it's really serving a function on both sides. It's an easier way to move horses, especially, particularly these horses of racing age. And obviously, as in the case we're just seeing with Caravelle, you know, somebody could have had that mare last year for a fraction of what she's now sold for. And by the way, Wanamaker's it was co-founded by Liza Hendricks, who's Elizabeth Merriman's daughter.
Right. That's right.
So, so it's, you know, it's been a family affair for them on that. It's been very successful. It has to have a lot of these other digital sales, as you pointed out.
What else caught your attention about this story and about, you know, about Caravelle in general? I kind of walked through the mating decisions that that Lizzie had made with the dam, and actually, you know, the family's quite interesting, and I noticed right away that the second dam, and I saw right away that it was Satish. It was a Padua product, so that, you know, that interested me. And of course that ZZ that was quite successful, actually. But she's utilizing essentially the local, you know, local access, and including Anchor and Hope, Dr. Merriman's his stallion service that he's got down there.
Yeah, and you know, I have a kind of a personal relationship with it in this sense. In the 70s, I was a kid, a teenager, growing up, following racing, and, a filly that I actually followed was the filly Twixt, who was one of the great Maryland breds of all time, that was bred by Lizzie Merriman's parents, John and Kitty Merriman. They had a well-established farm in Maryland, Laura Banks, and it was very similar to this, to Lizzie Merriman's handling of Caravelle, because it was that kind of tradition, Steve. The parents bred Twixt, and they raised her with a relative, Mrs. John Franklin, a cousin, or the cousin's wife, and she was trained by Katie Ross, the oldest daughter of the Merrimans, and Lizzie Merriman's oldest sister. And, you know, she was a grade one winner back then and earned a lot of money, was a Maryland bred Hall of Famer, was the most winningest Maryland bred, I think, at the time of her retirement. But a couple of things, the parallels, the parents, for example, they got Twix's dam very inexpensively. They bred her to a Sagamore Stallion, Alfred Vanderbilt Stallion, a cheap one, who'd only made 3 starts. He won 2 races, rest is native, standing for $1,000. They got Twix, and, you know, the same type of patient handling. Didn't race it too, and had an illustrious career from there onwards. And it's kind of a milieu that I became very familiar with. A lot of people during that period had the similar type of WASPy background, that type of preppy horsemanship. You know, like John Merriman went to Andover Phillips. I think he went for part time to Cornell. Lizzie Merriman went to Cornell. You know, educated people, very much immersed in that horse world, whether they were showing ponies or cattle. John Merriman was a big Guernsey breeder and collected Guernsey bulls and sold them. And so there's this real affiliation with the land, the livestock, the horses, you know, that type. It was a real distinct milieu in that region, and so kids grew up, you know, showing horses, hunters. You know, it was that's timber country racing, timber racing. You know, over fences, and everybody kind of had horses, homebred that they kind of bred inexpensively, whether it's, like you point out, a stallion down the road, or in this case, Lizzie Merriman got this mare free, and she was a turf. She won on turf, so she sent it to Mrs. Mask, you know, a lower-level stallion, stud fee-wise, who's a grass specialist, you know, to kind of work on that type of breeding. And, you know, they foal them at their farms. They're very, very attuned to the land. And, you know, they kick them around and bring them around slowly. These aren't the type of horses that are bred for the sales ring. And it's not their priority. Their priority is, you know, to get them and race. And it's just a part of a lifestyle, Steve, that was so prevalent back then. I mean, I remember even in Maryland during this exact same era, there's a guy named Bob Beal. He owned a restaurant. He actually had his own backyard stallion, and he had a couple of mares, very similar to this kind of thing, you know, Bob Beal. The stallion he had was a stallion named Friend's Choice. Son of Crimson Satan, and from his backyard program, he bred the very good sprinter Dave's Friend in Maryland, who he originally trained and raced before Dave's Friend was sold to John Franks. You know, Dave's Friend earned over $1 million, but, you know, Dave's Friend, very similar to this, you know, he was just Robert Beal bred him in Maryland, the stallion Friend's Choice. His own stallion was just a winner. He'd never won a stakes race. But, you know, he guy's running a restaurant that he's training a few horses on the side. The horse was so much a part of these people's lives. And, you know, I wistfully recall that era because it was really... for lack of a better word, it was a really charming thing to see. You know, that horses were part of everyday life for a lot of these people. And that, in my column, even though it's writing about this, that's the undercurrent, that kind of lifestyle, which can be successful, and which is such a huge part of the tapestry of the game, is diminishing as we become, you know, the game gets smaller and the bigger guys get larger, as they pointed out. And it becomes, for the lack of a better word, a more corporate thing. You know, it's like the big bookstores coming in and knocking out the mom-and-pop operations, or the big grocery stores are knocking out the mom-and-pop groceries. You know, it's just part of society where we're headed. But you wistfully think back to, you know, the craftsmanship that goes into some of these smaller things, and how much a part of people's lives the horse was, you know. And so even though that's the front of the story talks about, you know, Caravelle and whatnot, the undercurrent to it is a longing for a time that's passed, in a way. You know what I'm saying?
And, no doubt.
People like you, even with DT and stuff, what you're doing, that's almost part of that era. You know, there you are. You've sent your mare, you bred to, say, Motown, and, you know, under a stallion 75 or under. And, you know, you want to raise your horse and you want to try to race it and breed it. Well, that's part of that ethos, you know?
No doubt. No doubt. And it's what's become so difficult for the game slash sport slash industry to defend itself against critics, because as we've said for years and years and years, the distancing of society from an agrarian lifestyle, it puts pressures on all of us that, you know, a public at large doesn't understand, and you know, there's a whole bunch of tangential companion
very much
elements to this. You know, the deification of the dog and cat as a pet, and you know, particularly you know, the dog moving from a doghouse in the backyard into the house, and being, you know, being there's just a whole different mindset that has evolved here, I suppose, post-war, and it's increasingly difficult to explain this as a lifestyle choice to people, and especially as, you know, families like the Merrimans, when there's less and less of them, that means there's also less and less, you know, people from the outside world that have, you know, any ability to, you know, to have a connection or any context with it. You know, I discussed this a lot with the Clancys, you know, another example. And, you know, you can go coast to coast in every region. You know, there's these kinds of, you know, the throwback scenarios in terms of lifestyle choice, and I don't know, Sid. It's not going to get easier. It's gonna get more difficult to put this, you know, in context with people. And you know, there's also some resentment, I think, that with this perception, you know, that everybody involved is are multimillionaires, and you know, this is all a frivolity. It's not.
Right.
It's an industry. It's a business. It's a lifestyle choice. It's something so anachronistic that's its biggest its biggest charm, its greatest charm, and its largest threat and detriment.
That's very, very eloquently put. Your monologue there was superb. I concur with it 100%. You know, part of the lack of industry foresight into this starts with the idea of trying to collect power at the top. And by doing that, what the industry at large has done is they've hastened the departure of these types of people, and it's reflected in the venues in which a lot of these people would race, like Suffolk Downs, say, in Massachusetts, or, you know, any number of these smaller tracks were areas where these people had, you know, raced their horses. A lot of these smaller tracks and venues, for example, had the support of the states and the Department of Agriculture, which made sure, for example, that there were breeding awards for state-bred horses, which helped these types of folks, right? We've gotten away from that. There's this feeling within the industry that we shouldn't, at the lower end, help anybody with state breeder, owner, and stallion awards, while at the same time, these guys at the top will turn around and say, however, we need your casino money for the top end. And so this lack of understanding of people that are supposed to be guardians of the entire industry, you know, what they've done is they've put their own hands out to make sure that they get the money at the top end while they fight to make sure that the smaller guys get eliminated. And along with their benefits, so to speak. So this is a thing that it's hard for people to understand because there's so many moving parts in this game, and the game is so polarized among various factions. So you've got, you know, bettors, you know, they don't care about this kind of stuff. You know, you've got consolidation at the top, say, with the jockey club. They're really more concerned about the top end of the game. You've got then tracks competing with one another with casino backing, and they're more concerned about the casino element of the game, and they'll throw money into you, but they don't really care much about growing the game in which they got grandfathered in to get those casinos, you know? So there's so many different parts to it. And unfortunately, like in society at large, it's a regular guy that's getting jerked around.
Well, and
in this case,
along,
it's a smaller horseman.
Right. And along those lines, that's a topic that, you know, most recently, for those that heard John Sikora, you know, pretty much rail against, and the great frustration that that everybody should be pulling in the same direction, but there's certain interests that are so self-absorbed and self-prioritizing to the greater detriment of, you know, of the game, and it's. It's exasperating, to be honest, and it's why, you know, it's why some people have either quietly or loudly, left the game, and there are people, people that we can't afford to, in a lot of cases, people we really can't afford to lose. And, you know, and then there's been other people that have dug their heels in and have. Tried to improve, tried to ameliorate the. The area that they found offensive. I think about Jess Jackson and what Jess Jackson's what he did in terms of advocating and effectively actually shining a light regarding sales integrity. I'm sure a certain percentage that aren't even don't even remember that, and it's really not that long ago. Satish, think about Satish.
Satish is another guy who got buried fighting for causes.
I mean, obviously, Jess had was sick and. We lost them that way. Satish had a different, took a different route, and is back, he's back working. At some point, I think Satish will he'll come back with something. I talk to him, he keeps one eye open about coming back. I think about a guy like Al Gold, who exposed a corruption, and instead of walking away. Dug his heels in and has stayed, very active. That's just one, sidetracked to one area, but, the horse players, virtually every horse player that, that comes back and tries, to win, despite things that work against them. I mean, there's an infrastructure that makes it already hard to win. It's expensive to participate. Bet structuring and the cost of bets is out of whack. Again, there's a real reason for it, and people try to simplify it. Oh, it's industry greed. Not exactly industry greed. It's a cumbersome structure with too many hands in the pocket is part of the problem, but that's the way the game evolved. I say all the time, one of the game's great difficulties that it faces is its age and where it started. It was tied into, you know, into government as a government resource. That's how it became the only legal wagering opportunity, the only gambling, until casino gaming, it was the only legal gaming for decades upon decades. So, you know, government used it as a piggy bank. That part of it, we're sort of burdened with. Then you start folding in the off track system that had to invent itself in the 70s. And there were terrible mistakes made because there was really no blueprint how to do it. But that's how we get to the point where bricks and mortar makes less on wagers than an operation that has no overhead compared to the racetrack. And this is the Fred Pope inverted pyramid conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I don't know how we got here. I do know how we got here because when you discuss anything serious, there's serious elements to it. Let me slip in. I want to talk to you about Maracuja as well. And the honor code, big win for honor code. But before we do that, I do want to let you know we got 12 minutes to the fourth at Glorious Goodwood, and the Sussex goes today. The Group One, of course, and it's a win and you're in for the mile, and plenty of familiar names and faces. Poetic Flair back for Jim Bulger, and the Dawn Approach Colt, your current 6-5 favorite. How about Order of Australia, the Breeders' Cup Mile shocker, back for Aidan O'Brien, Ryan Moore, 4-1. Lope E. Fernandez, who in some ways has kind of leapfrogged the Order of Australia, although in this particular setting, 7-1, third choice in the Sussex. So, alcohol free for Andrew Balding actually is 5-1, and so is Snow Lantern down below the fold, as it were. So very good. You know, if it's not Poetic Flair, it could be any of another four or five. So we'll look forward.
Jim Bulger's obviously incredibly bullish on his colt, a dual guineas winner, as well as he won the St. James's Palace. And I read somewhere where, he was making comparisons to the Frankel's performance in the race with his colt. So, I mean, he's as bullish as you can get. It's interesting you mention him because he's one of those anomalies that exist in Europe, very much like Elizabeth Merriman. He breeds, owns, and trains his own horses, and it's obviously he's the big standout in Europe for that type of thing. And, you know, even, for example, Poetic Flair is by Dawn Approach, you know. Dawn Approach happens to be, a Bulger bred by his mom, bred by him and raised by his mom, had originally been won the Guineas too, the Bulger, and the St. James's Palace, just like the Poetic Flair, then was sent to Darley for stud, and has now just been repatriated because of his lack of commercial appeal back to Bulger's own farm. So here's the European version of what we were just talking about before. The owner, trainer, breeder with the horse, his own horses, and, going up against the big guns. And that's Jim Bulger in a nutshell.
Well, current with about 9 minutes to post. six to five holds. No movement actually. And I do want to quickly dance over to my retweet this morning of our man Kev Humphries. And Kev's,
who's he like?
He's on poetic flair. He's kind of acquiescing, and he does make Tilsit actually interesting. He makes Tilsit, who is 17-1 and happens to be a Judmont product, a first defense colt for Charlie Hills. He's hooking up Tilsit with poetic flair. Poetic flair now even money on the market, and so 9-6 for Kev, but he's excluding Coolmore completely. No Bally Doyle for our man, the long shot lad.
Mm-hmm.
And I retweeted it, but then I got busy this morning, kind of catching up on some things. Yeah, we were gone. Andy Serling called me yesterday, and he said, "Are you staying around? You're gonna come to Saratoga, or are you heading to, you know, you're heading to Prairie Meadows next?" He was giving me the business for being out of town, 2 weeks in a row with Haskell and with Colonial, but let me think. Did Kev? No, he went reaching for a big price in the third. I was just seeing if he had found anything juicy leading up to this fourth race, the Sussex at Glorious Goodwood, about 7 minutes away. Sid, that's a perfect opportunity for us to talk about Maracuja. And here's a grade one win for Honor Code. And this filly, I made the point, and in fact, I think we'll probably have Paul Matisse with us tomorrow live at Saratoga. But Paul had pointed out after Oaks Derby weekend that her trip really meant you could put a line through her Kentucky Oaks. And Rob Attriss, made a beeline for this opportunity, built everything toward the Oaks, and then executes it brilliantly. You know, the short field, I don't know. I don't see why even a bigger field was going to deny her on Saturday. This is it's a huge win for Rob Attriss, of course, worked for Robertino Diodoro, and is really, he and his wife Brittany have really crafted a nice career for themselves at the highest level. And this is a huge win for them, and also for Beach Haven, the ownership group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and interestingly, you know, this filly, I kind of remember her because I believe she sold at Fraser Tipton.
Yeah, Saratoga. Yeah, sure did. $200,000.
I remember this one because it was purchased by Jason Service, if I'm not mistaken. Let me look. At any rate, Honor Code's first grade one winner, who's now at Stead of Lane's End from his first crop, the flashy colt, name escapes me now. You know, the colt I'm talking about, won the Santa Anita Derby.
Oh my God. Why do you do this to me?
Out of the mare you love.
Yes, out of Hollywood Story.
Yeah.
Oh my God, what the hell?
Oh,
holy cow, I'm
yeah,
my brain is mush.
John Sherris trained him.
Yeah, but exactly, yeah. Exactly.
At any rate, so that horse sold at the sale too, and now that was his first grade one winner. And
Honor AP,
yeah. Honor AP sold at that sale. He made a lot of money, like $850. He just stood out. He was like a man among boys in the back ring. And this filly, I remember her as well the following year, and she now has come out of the same sale too. So it's interesting that Honor Code's only two grade one winners, with only two three crops now racing, pretty good record. Both came out of the same sale. I like this filly because her unbridled song, Dan, as you mentioned, was a half sister to the Dam of Rockport Harbor, who's also by Unbridled Song. And, you know, Rockport Harbor won the Remsen, and, you know, a pretty good horse. It's a really nice pedigree. And the young dam now, well, now, the mare now has her first stakes from her. She wasn't a young dam, I take that back. But I like the fact that, you know, her half-sister produced a graded black type winner. And actually another half-sister produced the dam of one. So it was an older family, but it just shows you that you never know when they have the ability to produce a black type horse, and now you've got a grade one winner. It makes the pedigree really more current, fills it out really nicely. All that Dam needed was a black type winner to fill out the entire pedigree. Sometimes families get old and they get stale, and horses get penalized in the sales ring because there's nothing current in it, particularly in sort of in direct lines. And now this just fixed the entire thing, Steve, because the dam, Patty's Regal Song, she's 15 this year, and she's the dam of grade one winner, and it's her first black type winner, even though she herself had some black types, she takes place. And this is a good family. It's got appealing tail in it. Appealing tail, the tail of the cat who won the Kelso G2. You know, it's dotted with some good black type in it up front. And, you know, this filly is really going to be quite a valuable mare now. Just even if she does nothing from this point onwards. But obviously she's got a chance to, you know, have a championship run as well now.
And for Beach Haven, you know, they had that staple, that New York bred, newly minted, that Larry Best, they sold that one in November. So mm-hmm. from a limited set of runners, they really have had big success. I'm looking forward. We've been trying to scare up Rob and or Brittany Attris, and we will get them at maybe tomorrow live. If nothing else, I'll wrangle them. But it's a great story, and the fact that that Attris really focused in at after the Oaks on this and just put everything into being ready for this opportunity, that's a nice feather in the proverbial cap.
It really is, and to beat an undefeated filly like that, who everybody was, you know, raving about as, you know, of the highest class. And obviously, she is. She did nothing wrong. She almost won. But yeah, to beat a rival like that, particularly.
Let me pull in Goodwood here, and let's pick him up.
Next, and then as they come to the halfway point into the straight, Space Traveler and Danny Toto at the back marker. Century Dream has committed for home and gone on here. Leads by over a length now to Ward of Australia in second place. Poetic Flair coming through to try and take second position, but having a bit of trouble to do so. Till sits behind those. Then comes Lopi Fernandez, Alcohol Free being brought down the center of the course, but it's the green jacket of Century Dream. Here is Poetic Flair to join him. Alcohol Free Lopi putting in her challenge. Order of Australia and Lopi Fernandez are the next pair at the furlong pole. It's the white jacket of Poetic Flair, but nearest to us, Alcohol Free. The filly has gone through to take it up in the closing stages. Tight between them, Alcohol Free has a very narrow advantage to Poetic Flair. Alcohol Free and Hashim Murphy have won the Qatar Sussex. Poetic Flair in second, so Lantern behind those in third to Hale and Order of Australia, the next pair. It's Alcohol Free who wins the Sussex Stakes. Three-year-old fillies don't have a great record in the race, but has seen off.
There's a mild upset and no excuse really for Poetic Flair, who took over and looked like, you know, the opportunity to, you know, to power home essentially. And instead, Alcohol Free, Andrew Balding, O'Shane Murphy, actually took late money too, went from 5-1 down to 7-2. And, meanwhile, Poetic Flair had gone all the way down to 4-5. So, the 10 and the 9, the two O'Briens that certainly, Breeders' Cup viewers are familiar with the Order of Australia and Lope Fernandez, they really they were not part of this. So a no nay never filly wins the Sussex. This is nice. I mean, the Irish bred, but the American bred sire, no nay never.
Yeah, and also this is a mare with some really good form behind her. I mean, she was a group one winner at 2. And she won the Coronation Stakes, this year, G1. Pretty good form.
Interesting, too, with that comment that the three-year-old fillies aren't necessarily, all that potent in the Sussex. But we've had three-year-old fillies come over and do well in the Breeders' Cup Mile.
Yeah,
and I'm trying to think quickly. I'm going to pull it up because I know that that's been a decent angle to some degree. And I'm going to quickly. Teppan was Goldakova, of course. Goldakova.
Miesque.
Yeah, there you go, Miesque. Yep, Miesque, the first of her two. It is pretty amazing when you look at, it's funny when you look at the mile and you see Freddie Head with the two wins in the irons and the three wins as a trainer. It's just unbelievable. Who was it was a huge score for me. The filly that beat the Shiverly Park filly that beat Lady Eli, but that was the filly and mare turf as opposed to the mile. So there's at least two and there's Six Perfections. Six Perfections was a three-year-old, right?
Yeah,
there's a
there
filly.
You go, yeah.
There's another filly.
Yeah, I was going to say Flaxman would be the one to look at here.
Yep.
Flaxman sent, Miesque and...
Six Perfections.
In my mind, Miesque was one of the all-time great milers, and I've never forgiven Freddie Head once he started training Goldakova. Turn around and say that Goldakova was better than Miesque. Goldakova was great, but in my opinion, Miesque was a completely different horse. But that's what happens after you've ridden the horse. Now you have a new career as a trainer, and you've won it 3 times, and suddenly it's a whole new ballgame for you. And so you've now changed your opinion.
Well, and I just quickly added it up. 11 three-year-olds have won the Breeders' Cup Mile, and half of them female.
There you go. Flaxman Holdings must account for like four of those.
Oh, they've won Flaxman's. No, they've won more. I think they've won. Half a dozen.
Mies twice.
Yeah.
Arconte. Yeah, that's four right there.
Six Perfections, Dome Driver. Remember Dome Driver?
Dome Driver, that's right, yeah.
That was a significant, something of a significant upset. That was, that was a messy mile, right? You had the horse slip and created some havoc. But wasn't that Rock of Gibraltar's year? Because for a long time I used to say, if Rock of Gibraltar can get beat, then anybody can get beat. If a horse like that comes over and can't win, is denied, then you better be open to a lot of things. And there's the mile has produced plenty of fun, crazy results and prices.
Yeah, it really has.
Pretty fun. Well, there you go. So we've got a new name, and it's a win, and you're in. We'll see Alcohol Free what the intentions might be. We'll wait for some feedback. And now, of course, I've got to also sit now since I mentioned that other win.
For Foxman?
For Shiverly Park.
Right.
I've got to look it up. BC Filly and Mare. Because I don't know why I've tried to think of it before and I never remember. Her name just invariably. I struggle with, for whatever reason, it just doesn't stick in my head. Here we go, Breeders' Cup. They have an online.
I'm going to go outside and grab a smoke.
Go ahead. We've meandered here, but here we go. All right, the Filly and Mare Turf, and this was at Santa Anita. Queen's Trust. There we go.
Oh yeah. Not sure. Yeah, very good.
And 2016.
We struggle with names today.
Oh well, there's only. There's only so many you can keep in your head at any one time. Back to round out the conversation regarding Maracuja, Patty's Regal Song out of Unbridled Song Mare, then Regal Pennant, the second dam out of, or she herself out of a Camaran mare, Canadian. There's plenty of Canadian blood in here, but Banner Bob, the sire of the second dam. This has got a heavily Canadian female family where I see Vice Regal involved with the fourth dam. So it's kind of interesting. And then it melded with Unbridled Song to get this dam, Patty's Regal Song. And a glance at her, she slipped the year after Maracuja. But right now she's got a Twirling Candy half sister, that is the yearling, and there's a Sir Prancelot weanling. Interesting choice.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
How about that?
That's really interesting. Who's the breeder of Sir Prancelot?
I've only got the produce from the produce record. So I don't know yet if the mare. I don't know if the mare has changed hands at all. Let's see, from an auction. No, I don't. Well, let's see. Let me turn to Patty's Regal Song. And, Craig and Kathy Beam bred her. And then let's see the pattern, because there's been plenty. Interesting. She was sold to Checkmate Thoroughbreds. Buck Pond had her. And
yeah, Checkmate is that guy, Adrian Gonzalez, who owns Sir Prancelot or stands in California.
Well, there it is. There's your tie. And he actually bought Patty's Regal Song in full to Twirling Candy. So and paid $50,000. Holy cow.
Oh, what a great buy. And that's because we were just talking, she didn't have that black type, so the family was old and kind of stale.
Wow.
Now it's taken off. You see what I mean?
Amazing. What a crazy, and you want to talk about fluctuations. Listen to this, Sid. This is amazing. She originally sold for $57,000 as a yearling.
Yeah.
And in 2007, then after her career, $155,000 to Coronation Investments. Then Castleton Lyons bought her carrying a candy ride. That was in 2011 for $375,000. Then she was carrying a Malibu Moon when Ina Bond, Riverbend Farm, paid $3.25.
Yeah.
And that was in 2014. And then turns around, three more babies go through, and Checkmate buys her for just $50,000 with the twirling candy and amazing.
That,
and now
that twirling candy will bring a good amount of money at auction.
How about that?
Yeah. That's how, you know, that's what can happen in this game.
Well, and her first produce, Candy Charger, was the candy ride, and that was a colt. Ended up gelded, won four times, $87,000. She got a Gio Ponte that won twice for $19,000. That Malibu Moon, Lunar Lullaby, won one time for $17,000 in earnings. A Blame never made the races. And then came Island Song, a Spites Town, that did okay, won twice and eight board placements, $74,000. And here's Maracuja. And lo and behold, with her sixth produce,
you know, that speaks
she hits.
Very highly of Honor Code. That it was Honor Code, a unproven stallion, that was able to ignite her when all these top stallions, Malibu Moon, Candy Ride, Spice Town, did not have success with this mare. That's a real feather in the cap for this young stallion.
How about that? How about it? And now we'll have to check the catalogs and see if this twirling candy. It's a filly. You know, it's funny. It's had five fillies and three boys. Interesting story,
yeah,
all around. It's one of those, you know, it's one of those things that we enjoy. It's, you know, let's be honest, we enjoy that.
Well, we're always happy when someone makes a score, whether it's in the stands on a pick four or, you know, buying a mare for $50,000 and presto, getting that mare turned into a grade one producer.
Well, Sid, we covered a lot of ground here.
we really covered a lot of ground.
this was a multiple topic visit, without a doubt. I love it.
Yep,
where are you, by the way? Are you
I'm
Florida?
I'm in Tampa, Florida.
You're still in Tampa. Okay. Wanted to make, yep. And everything all right?
Yeah. And, you know, going to the games and going to the beach and, you know, Joe's been making progress, doing well. Been hitting the ball hard, and slowly, you know, in the extended season, he led the team with a .370 average. Now they're in the Florida Complex League, and he's slowly building himself back up. He's at .270 right now. He's been through a streak. He's had 49 plate appearances with only five strikeouts, which is, you know, an incredible ratio,
wow.
10%. So he's hitting the ball, and he's hitting the ball hard. He just went through a streak where everybody was catching it. And some guys were making, you know, like Web Jim, it was really frustrating. Finally, the balls have been falling. So, you know, he started off like this. And in this league, by the way, he's the only infielder hitting .267. The next highest is like .210. So, you know, he's doing well, but obviously he feels he should be hitting well over 300, and I'm sure he will.
Well, that's in this era's sabermetric statistics. The line drive percentage and the luck factor gets there's that XBA the batting average with luck with the luck of the balls falling that it's so funny how that has really been incorporated and now you compared Sid to the era. In fact, there's that terrific '70s sports Twitter account that is so much fun that plucks things.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so much. The other day he put up the classic Sunday newspaper batting average and statistic columns, American League, National League. And it's just so funny. I mean, to see batting average, home runs, ribbies, stolen bases. Yeah. It's like this. This simple hieroglyphic. It's like stick figures on the wall. I subscribe to Baseball HQ, and. It's amazing. I mean, there's stuff that I can't even. I try to keep it simple. I don't drill down completely. But it is. It's like a whole new. It's a whole new world. And all fashioned from Bill James. In fact, what's been running on the cable is Moneyball has been on a lot this summer.
Oh yeah, that was a really good film.
It, really good, and of course the great book, Mark Hopkins.
Great book,
he also wrote a great book about the Eagles bringing the heat. Sid, this was great fun. I
a lot of fun, Steve. Thanks
always.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk Jim Dandy. We got Jim Dandy result, and we got a very good field that came together. For the curling that we're going to dig into, because there's going to be a couple of Travers and more than a couple Travers participants produced Friday and Saturday here at Saratoga.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
Sam, thanks a lot.
A couple of weeks, I'll be up at Saratoga, and I'll do a live. I'll meet you at your desk.
Without fail, and we'll be there tomorrow for a live session, and we'll...
You can meet Cynthia, my wife.
Oh, nice! Awesome! Yeah. Awesome! Excellent. All right. Well, then sales week, people, just like we said, that's where everybody congregates. I got Lenny Shulman sent me a text this morning. He got in last night, and Lenny's in for a month as well, so promoting his book.
Excellent.
Yeah, this is it. Now things.
I'm gonna have to ask you about some places to go and eat where I can sit outside.
You bet. Well, there's no shortage. That restaurateurs have who never thought about having outdoor dining. They all have it now. Everybody.
Yeah.
That may be one of the. One of the side benefits of what we've gone through is that some of your favorite places now have either a tent or a patio or, it's enhanced. In some cases, of course, it's, and you and Brooke back in Brooklyn said, I mean, it's crazy what transpired, right?
Yeah.
With all the sidewalk cafes that,
it was great.
They built those Quonset huts on the sidewalk. It's
right.